I'm your host. I'm Karen Hartglass, and we are about to start It's All About Food. How are you today? Can we talk about food? You know I love talking about food. And before we get started with the main focus of the show today, I wanted to really just talk about my lunch today. It was such a dream, phenomenal experience that I really need to savor it a little bit longer. So I hope you don't mind if I share it with you, because it was so spectacular. And there are a few things in the world that are so, from my point of view, so so important and spectacular. When people serve you food, and food that nourishes you, food that is going to energize you and get you through the day and make you creative and feel good, but food that's also fresh, that's gentle on the planet, and prepared with so much creativity. Now, normally, in order to get lovely vegan food, if I don't make it at home, because I normally make it at home, I'm fortunate to live in New York City, the greatest city in the world, where we have access to so many wonderful restaurants and so many wonderful vegan restaurants. And I did not go to a vegan restaurant today. I was invited to a restaurant called Rouge Tomate, and they focus on organic, sustainable foods, and they made a spectacular vegan presentation for us, four courses of incredible, beautiful, colorful, creative foods that were paired with biodynamic wines. And everything, every bite, I kept thinking, I wish this for the world. Of course, I would love to see hunger removed from the planet. No one should go to bed hungry. Everyone should have enough food to eat. But I don't believe that it is difficult to prepare food that is such a beautiful event, so memorable. Why can't we experience that every day? Every bite should be just, wow, that's what life is about. Simple, fresh, lovely pleasures that end up giving us things that will make us better. All right, that was my moment of savoring my lunch. Thank you for joining me with that. And now I want to move on to my first guest. But before I do, I wanted to mention that food, which is what I talk about, nourishes our bodies. But sometimes our mind is so powerful that with certain behaviors we may grow up with, certain cultures we may grow up with, it limits us to what we're able to do. It might limit the choices that are best for us. It might limit or affect the foods that we choose to eat and how we take care of ourselves. And the mind is pretty powerful. So what we're going to talk about today is how we can work with our own minds to make the choices that we want to make, things that are good for us. And I don't think it's that difficult. Not after reading the book that I just read, and we're going to be talking about that today. I'm going to introduce my guest. Tom Dotz founded the NLP, Neuro-Linguistic Programming Institute of California, in 1990, growing it in 4 years to the largest organization of its kind in the United States. In 1998, he acquired NLP Comprehensive, initiating new programs to keep it at the forefront of NLP. Tom has studied NLP since 1978 and is certified as an NLP Master Practitioner and Health Practitioner, and he has a new book called NLP, The Essential Guide, Creating the Person You Want to Be. Welcome to It's All About Food, Tom.
Well, thank you very much, Karen. It's my pleasure.
So I've read your book.
Wow, thank you.
I read the whole thing, and the frustrating part for me was I had to read it by today, and I just got it a few days ago. So I now have to go back, because there are so many great exercises and recommendations. And this is a big workshop in progress thing that I imagine I can go back to many times. But I just wanted to get through the whole thing and digest it so that we could talk about it. So let's just start. Let's just start with neuro-linguistic programming. That's a mouthful.
It is an awkward title. It's really about figuring out what I think of as functional models for how people work. And what I mean by that is simply a model or a representation of what people that are really successful at something do that makes their effort produce results that are exceptional. And I can apply that to something as basic as my meditation practice, or I can apply it to, as one of our students did, designing cockpits for fighter jets for the Air Force, because it touches on all sorts of human behaviors. And one of the most, I think, important and fundamental ways that we do go into the book is choosing outcomes that are really the right ones for you. Because I'm sure you know there have been times when you wanted to do something and you were completely congruent about it. And you might even have noticed, to your surprise, how many pathways opened up for you that you hadn't expected. Mm-hmm. Once you'd really chosen and you were really congruent about that. And maybe it was your course in college, maybe it was a job, maybe it was a relationship. But once you decided, once you were really congruent about that outcome, all sorts of things opened up for you, opportunities and possibilities that you wouldn't have expected might have come your way.
Yep. Open and receptive, and everything's flowing.
Right, right. That state of congruence, internal congruence, really has a very simple physical effect. It sets our perceptual filters. That is, it sets our mind in a certain form, in a certain format, so that we're now noticing the things that will move us forward towards that outcome. It allows us a kind of focus that's easy and natural, and it really furthers our movement and really furthers us towards accomplishing our goals. And that's probably one of the most fundamental elements of NLP. And in the book we go through, well, as you said, it's virtually a seminar or a workshop in between a couple of pages. We also, of course...
There's like 400 pages, yeah.
Okay. Well, we kind of got carried away.
And then and it's not just in the book. There are so many links to get more and bonuses from your website.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'm getting some really nice feedback on how the website turned out. People really enjoy it. I keep putting up more video examples and demonstrations and responding to what people want more of. Because we do have an enormous amount of resources, and I'm really happy to provide them to people.
Well, what I like is I have an engineering background, and I like when things are logical and you can explain something and it makes sense, and then I can apply it. And
yes.
And that's what this is. It's logical.
It
makes sense. And although I think many of us want to think that there are some things that we're born with, our personalities, our looks, and that can either be a bonus or a benefit or a limitation, what this is telling me is that we can, like you said, like the book says, creating the person you want to be. You can be anything that you want to be, and you spell out how to do it. It sounds kind of cliche, but I see how it can work. Now, I haven't had the opportunity, other than one of the first exercises in the book that you talked about, where you suggest imagining a time in your life when you felt you had all the possibilities and you felt really good and confident and to feel that.
Mm-hmm.
And I went through that exercise where I created that little button on my with my thumb and my middle finger to remember that. And it's, that's a simple little example, and it really works.
Yeah, it does.
It's magical.
It does seem that way at times. I frequently say that the challenging part about NLP is that it's so effective that somebody who's an absolute beginner can just wow anybody else on the planet with what they can do, because it is so powerful.
Now, I don't know if this is, I hate to use this expression, the chicken and the egg, which came first, but I just used it, so I apologize.
Yeah.
I apologize to the chicken and to the egg, but I've heard many, many things, bits and things I read in your book, I've heard from other sources, other self-help books or other therapies, and I'm not sure who tapped into who first, or maybe it all started somewhere and people are building on it. But for example, there was that documentary film that came out, The Secret, that talked about the law of attraction, and a lot of it seemed very fluffy and really sensational and focusing on, oh, you can make all of this money if you just believe it. But this book actually gets into the truth behind it and the work that you can do to really make some of those things happen. You can attract what you want.
Right. There's a, boy, there's some real slippage there. And I really don't have much truck with the general run of people who are promoting magical thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of The Secret was just that. It was magical thinking.
Right.
Well, I'm sorry, but I'd like them to show me one example of somebody who just sat in their studio apartment in Manhattan, closed the door, turned off the phone, and just waited for money to show up.
Right.
You know.
You have to do the work.
You got to do the work. And, you know, the thing is, work is not the opposite of play. Mm-hmm. If you're doing what you're really congruent about, like Warren Buffett said, he never went to work a day in his life.
Mm-hmm.
And he's been rather successful.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, it's like most people would go, yeah, that's a pretty good degree of success. It's about really being, I'll keep coming back to this because it's a really solid theme, and that's about being congruent, about really knowing what you want. And if you know what you want and you're really working towards that, it's not so much, yeah, you're exerting effort. In that sense, it's work because you're making an effort. But when you were a child and you were playing hopscotch, or you were, you know, playing with your friends, you were exerting a lot of effort. If you were running around the block, you were exerting effort, but it wasn't work. It was play. It was enjoyable. And when it comes to attracting success and wealth, a big part of that is being really clear about your outcome and retaining enough flexibility in the way of getting there so that you see what comes to you as opportunities, even if they may not look like one at the time. I remember one startup I was involved in years ago, we were calling on financial institutions, and I was one of the guys in the field, and I was talking to senior vice presidents, executive vice presidents at banks, and we were trying to convince them that the opportunity to offer insurance to their customers was a good idea. Well, we had a list of 47 different products and services that we could offer them. And there was one we put on there just at the last minute because it was a maybe possible. That was the one they bid on.
Mm-hmm.
And we wound up building a $200 million business inside of 24 months from zip.
Wow.
Because we listened and we watched and we saw what they wanted. And we were flexible enough to respond to what our customers wanted. We had the outcome in mind. We wanted to build a successful, large business in the financial institution sector. But we wound up doing what's now called subprime financing, securitizing subprime financing.
Mm.
Yes, I'm sorry, I was involved in that. Yeah, I know. Back in the 80s.
Okay, it seemed good at the time.
It seemed like a great idea.
Yeah.
We really felt we were giving people a second chance.
Right, sure.
And it turned out a little bit differently. But it was an example of, you know, having an outcome in mind and moving towards that while retaining enough flexibility, enough resilience to respond to the signals in your environment.
I'm not someone that uses a lot, self-help books very often. Mm-hmm. I know some people are really into them, and I'm not saying they're good or they're not good. But one of the things that normally annoys me in a book is when there's a worksheet and things that you're supposed to do, because I think, oh, you know, this is trivial. This is a waste of time. I don't feel that about what's in your book.
And, thank you.
And, yeah. So, the first thing is, I mean, you make it sound so simple. Just know what it is you want to do. And so many people don't know what they want to do. And so you give an exercise where you make four columns, what you want to have, what you don't want to have, and what you have but don't want to have. I'm probably not getting it exactly right. but it really helps figure out what you want.
Yeah. There's a system and there's a process for sorting through that.
Mm-hmm.
And we included it in the clearest and simplest way we can, and I hope it works for people because it's really effective. And you're right. There are a whole lot of people who say, well, gee, I just wish I knew what I wanted, if I really knew what I really wanted, and if I knew it was really worth having, well, I'd really go for it. Well, that's why part of the reason we wrote this book, because there are processes that help you sort that out and determine it and know, you know, with complete confidence that this really is appropriate for you and it is going to be good for you and for the rest of the people in your life, too. And one of the things that you probably noticed in there, and it may be something you come back to revisit, is that we also consider when you're thinking about your outcomes what we call your environment. And by that, we don't mean just the planet, although that's certainly a part of it. We mean your human environment, your relationships, your family. How's it going to impact them? Because one of the things you'll notice as you start really changing and moving more into becoming the person you really want to be is that people around you are changing too.
Mm-hmm. That could be good or that could be not so good.
Some people may find it real challenging. If you're someone who's, you know, always been a procrastinator and never got anything done on time, and suddenly you're completing things ahead of schedule and you're moving right on, people around you might find that kind of disconcerting.
Yeah, but people may not be ready to change because change is hard.
For some people, it can be threatening even.
Yeah, threatening.
Mm-hmm.
Now, neuro-linguistic programming, I don't think most people have heard about it, and yet it's been around for a very long time. Why isn't everybody talking about it?
Boy, that's a good question. It has been around since the 70s,
mm-hmm.
and it was widely heralded when it first came along because it was producing some really remarkable results. And it actually is quite well known. It's really funny. It's another one of those cases of, an expert is somebody who's 50 miles from home with a briefcase and a prophet not getting any recognition in his own country.
Mm-hmm.
It's much more widely known in Europe and even in Russia.
And it is...
And here's the other thing. In America, where it has really transitioned into the mainstream is as a component of a lot of brief therapies, training courses, self-help books. A friend of mine was reading this book called Firestarter, and she said, oh, there's this wonderful process in there called the Disney Creativity Strategy. And I said, really? No kidding. And did they mention where it came from? She said, no, it's just in the book. And I said, yeah. Created by Robert Diltz back in the late 70s. And that's also in our book, too, in Chapter 8, I think, as I recall. And it's a wonderful strategy for creativity, as well as for coming up with new possibilities and finding out how they align and really moving them into a workable plan, which is another really valuable function to have. In America, getting back to your question, NLP is included a lot in management training classes. However, it's rarely referred to or labeled as NLP. And part of this is because the consultants who are marketing their services want to market their services.
Right, okay.
Yeah. A good friend of mine, Frank Bork, is a psychotherapist in Corning, New York, and he's putting together a program. They're developing a program to work with veterans on PTSD using to us, it's conventional NLP.
Post-traumatic stress disorder.
Right.
PTSD. Okay.
Right. He's working with the feds to get a grant, and they've come quite a long ways towards it. In any case, because he's based in Corning, he's also frequently invited to Corning Glass to observe various things that they're doing. And one time he was invited to one of their training courses, and he sat there through the morning, and at lunchtime went up and talked to the guy and said, "You're doing NLP." And I went, oh my God. Yes, actually.
Yeah, gotta make a living.
Yeah, okay. Gotta make a living, yeah.
Well, these skills can be used for an individual to work on themselves. It can be used for an individual who is having a challenging relationship, either a romantic partner or someone in the family or someone they're working with. I know that we can only control ourselves, but sometimes it can be so challenging when you're working with people that make things difficult. And to some extent, you can use these skills to make a difference. And then the larger scale working in business, and it's there's really great things in here. Now, I want to talk about some specific cases. So this show is called It's All About Food, and I love talking about food. And we're here, it's 2013, and obesity is soaring. People are overweight. I think the entire country has a food disorder.
Mm-hmm.
And it's from our culture. It's we're being marketed. We have all these foods that are so unhealthy for us. And I'm imagining that for some people that are challenged with food, they could actually use some of these skills to help them get to a better diet.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. Most assuredly. You know, and again, starting with what do you want to accomplish? What do you want? You want a better diet. What does that really mean to you? This is the kind of simple exercises that we include in the book that gently guide you through what's important about that to you, you know? Because when you can really get in touch with your deepest motivation, then it starts to help you roll forward into the new plans and the little changes you make in your daily life that add up to the differences that give you the results you really want.
Now, I want to help the entire country. To help them change their diet. And I know that there are a lot of people, they listen to this show or they hear me talking somewhere about food and they'll ask me. And it's great when someone's interested and they want information and I can share with them. That's easy. But for the people that need help and they don't even know what it is they need, the question I have is how can I change my presentation so that I can get to more people and help them get to a better place with their food? That's my challenge.
Well, it's a matter of finding what motivates them, what gets their interest, what gets their attention. So if you want to consider our society as a whole and not one that we fall into, although we certainly do, it's people want to be, they want attractive, they want to be well-liked, they want to be successful. So how can changing a diet to one that is more sustaining help people do that? Gosh, there's a lot of examples. And in my personal diet history, I've been vegetarian, I've been and done vegan retreats at the Bhakti's Institute and stuff like that. And one of the secrets I found out was that the raw foods diet, for instance, is one that Hollywood starlets will frequently go on for a couple of weeks just before they've got some very important auditions.
Mm-hmm.
Why do they do that? Because it clears their skin amazingly.
Yep.
It gives them a glow like they were 19 again. And it comes from the inside out, which is real different from the result they get after 4 hours of expert makeup.
Right.
And that's about the only other way they can do that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think if you want to attract society as a whole to a change in its orientation towards diet and food, then you look for what is attracting them that you would want, that you would be congruent about using as a way to get attention.
Mm-hmm.
So that, and also you've got the baby boomers who are hitting that age where they've got some real valid concerns about their long-term health, about their mental acuity.
Absolutely, yep.
Yeah. Well, you know that there's an enormous amount that diet can do to influence your long-term health, your well-being, and your mental acuity in particular. I think perhaps that's the greatest trigger for people reaching their 60s and their 70s.
Mm-hmm.
It's one thing to lose your physical abilities, but I think it's even more frightening to consider the possibility of losing one's mental abilities.
Absolutely, yeah. And it's amazing. I always like to say, you don't know how good you can feel.
Mm-hmm.
I just want everybody to be happy and not have pain and not suffer. That's all. That's all I want.
That's all.
That's all.
Let me know when you come up with a big goal.
and then, you know, you mentioned that when we make changes, we have to anticipate, if we can, what what those how those changes are going to impact the people around us. And I know a lot of people, when they're changing their diet in particular, have a lot of problems with their families because food is so ingrained in our culture and tradition and holidays, and people get scared and threatened, like you said before.
Sure.
Yeah. So
yeah, I'm part of a large family, and I had those experiences at Thanksgiving dinner. My brother-in-law kind of looking down his nose at me like, you're not eating turkey? Well, actually, I'm not. It's okay with me. I don't know why it bothers him.
Yeah, it's so threatening.
Yeah, it's really funny because it doesn't, you know, I think it's that there's a feeling that it's a judgment of some kind. And that could very well be the source of it.
Well, there is something to it. We may or may not be judging, but the person who feels threatened feels judged because I think there's something internally that is in conflict with what's going on, and they're judging themselves.
Mm-hmm. Could very well be the case, yeah. And although my brother-in-law is one hale and hearty guy, there are a whole lot of other people who, in a similar situation, would have some pretty valid reasons for going, oh, God, you know, feeling judged because in their mind it's pointing out to them where they've been kind of lacking in taking care of themselves.
So is there something with NLP that we can use to make the people around us feel more comfortable with our change?
Well, rapport skills, which we certainly go into in the book, can go a long ways towards making people feel comfortable around you and feeling more comfortable around people, regardless of what you're discussing or what the particular situation is.
Okay, I'm going to have to become a master at this. I have a question. You talk about when you're with people, we all do physical things with our bodies, and when we are congruent, perhaps, with someone, we start to mimic each other.
Well, let me back up a little bit.
Okay.
We use congruent in a really technical sense, I guess you could say, in the book. And what you're describing is more what we call matching or mirroring, and it's a part of rapport skills.
Mm.
And we have, you know, in NLP, we've developed some really fine-grained technology around rapport, and it not in the general public rapport is usually thought of as, well, you get along well with people, and that's what's considered rapport. And I remember way back in the ancient history when I went to my first sales training class, and the guy said, well, now the first thing you got to do with your prospect is get rapport, and we all wrote down get rapport and nod our heads. And then he went on, and the next thing is, and he never went back to what rapport was, how you'd get it, or how you'd know if you had it.
Or how to spell it.
That either. So in NLP, we make some really, really good distinctions about how to establish rapport, how to maintain it, and how to break it. Because you don't always want to have rapport with everyone.
Hmm.
Like that pushy salesman who, you know, just can't seem to get the message that you're not interested in what he's got to offer. It's really handy to be able to break rapport with a person like that.
So my question is, when I'm with someone and I've noticed that we're mimicking each other, and before I read this book, I started to notice that sometimes. And
excellent.
So sometimes I would break it because I thought, well, I don't want them doing what I'm doing.
Yeah.
So what happens when you break it? What feeling does the other person get?
Generally, they're not going to be aware of it consciously.
Mm-hmm.
It's very rare that anyone is. And generally, they're just going to feel a little bit of a distance, or it's a little bit in a natural interaction with someone. When the interaction is drawing to a close, people will stop mirroring or matching each other as closely. It's just a part of our disengagement process.
Mm.
So when you lead by starting that disengagement process, it's just a signal to someone else, like saying, oh, well, gosh, I've got to go now. It's just a subtler and gentler way of doing it.
Okay, well, on that note, I should say, oh, gosh, I got to go now.
Whoa!
No, I mean, Tom, we're at the end of our half hour, and that went fast.
Boy, you planned that really well. My hat's off to you.
Thank you so much for joining me. I can't wait to get to work on all my assignments here in NLP, The Essential Guide to Neurolinguistic Programming. Thanks for joining me on It's All About Food.
Hey, it's my pleasure indeed. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. I'm Karen Hartglass. You're listening to It's All About Food, of course. And we're going to take a break and then come back and talk with Dr. Barb Arno and the Aztec Diet. We'll be right back. Everybody, I'm back. I'm Karen Hartglass, the host of It's All About Food. Thank you for joining me on this lovely February 19, 2013. And wherever you are, I'm sending out some really energized good vibes to you wherever you may be and wishing you well. So we're going to talk more about food, my favorite subject, and let's get right on to my next guest, Dr. Barb Arno. Physician and avid chia advocate, is a New York Times bestselling author and has written 14 previous books on nutrition and health topics. He has been a medical correspondent for NBC Nightly News, Dateline NBC, The Today Show, CBS Evening News, 60 Minutes, and CBS This Morning, and he is a health columnist for Men's Journal. He lives in Palm Beach, Florida, and spends his winters in Vermont. Welcome to It's All About Food.
Boy, what a great introduction. Thank you so much. Very appreciative.
Okay, now you are like Superman, are you not? Is there nothing you haven't done? you've been all around the world climbing everything.
I hadn't sung, so actually when I took opera lessons, I don't think you want to ask me to do it, but...
Sing with me. I sing opera. Let's sing a duet.
How about the beginning of Don Giovanni?
Okay.
Che bene!
That's very good.
This chia has just, you know, remade my life. I mean, I ski race 5 days a week during the winter. I do 100-mile bike races in the summer. I did the Molokai, Oahu, 32-mile open ocean stand-up paddling race this summer with 28-foot swells and 35-knot winds. So, you know, it's interesting that the ancient Aztecs actually went into battle only with chia. They would fight the Spanish for weeks at a time only with chia. The Tarahumara runners you hear about and Born to Run. Again, they're out there in these 100-plus-mile runs, fueling themselves only with chia. But the real miracle here really has been in weight loss. I mean, I have never seen anything like it. Never. I mean, it really does act almost as if you had lap band surgery in the sense that it fills you up. You just don't feel like eating. So I've never felt better. I've never seen a diet where basically you don't have that brain-searing hunger and you feel amazingly great and you feel full. Seems to be too good to be true, but it isn't. I mean, it really works. And we have 2 years of clinical trials with real women and real men who've had terrible weight loss problems, who've finally been able to get that weight loss done and have never felt better in their lives.
Chia is an amazing food, and if you just add water to it, you kind of see how it fluffs up and gets all gummy and filling.
But the big thing you know with the Aztec diet was to take chia, which is terrific. It's great on its own, but the fact of the matter is if you just throw it on your burger and fries, it's not going to do that much for it. It'll do a little bit. We really wanted to take the entire Aztec experience to give people foods that have staggering amounts of antioxidants in it, totally fill them up and make them feel great. And the big thing, you know, is it kills what we call micronutrient hunger. In other words, you could have burgers and fries all day long, and you're still going to be hungry. Why? Because you don't have all the minerals and vitamins and antioxidants that you need. So it solves these really big problems in a wonderful and fun way. You know, day one, you start out with these smoothies or shakes, and you have staggering inflammation levels that are just dropped down into the sewer. You're able to take your glucose load, which is the number one reason that we're overweight, and again, just drop it into the sewer and not have the hunger that, you know, really, you know, is what kills people with diets, you know, that they just can't do it that long because they feel just so terrible with brain-searing pain.
Okay, it's very obvious that you're full of energy, and people probably say that they get exhausted just listening to you. But I want to say something first. I am a vegan, and I promote a plant-based diet, but I love talking to different people who have their ideas about diets and what works. And what I like to do is talk about the things where we're aligned. Clearly, everybody has differences, but there are things that we're aligned on, and I think it's so important that we all come together and talk about the things that we agree on, because we can all move faster forward that way. So it's really clear that here in the United States, we have this horrible obesity epidemic. I think I said this earlier, but we all have this bad food disorder. We're marketed to eat all the wrong foods, and it's a nightmare.
And actually, you know, the Aztec diet over the weekend hit number 9 on the Amazon bestseller list, but more importantly, number 2 on the vegetarian bestseller list. And, you know, it's largely a vegetarian diet. You can be a total vegan on it. You know, I'd say 98% of the time vegetarian. But the key thing is this. The Aztec grains allow you to be vegetarian in a very easy way. Why? Because, you know, there's amino acid score. 100 or above means you have a complete protein. Well, chia is like 115. We have 3 or 4 grains that are all over 100. And by comparison, you know, a ground round's only 92 and a hamburger 68. So you easily get the proteins you want. You fill yourself up. And then, you know, when I get up in the morning, I have, you know, kale, blueberries, spinach, watercress, you know, all thrown into a mixer with chia and a little bit of honey. And it's just staggeringly great.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, and I do lots and lots of exercise, and I don't have any muscle pain, and I don't have any protein deficiency, largely because the Aztecs figured it out before anybody else. And that is how you get all the protein you need out of a completely vegetarian diet.
Yeah, and I was very sad to read in the beginning of your book when you were talking a little bit about Aztec history, how they had fields and fields of chia growing, and the Spaniards came along and realized that was the secret to their success, so they destroyed them.
It was such a tragedy, because, you know, I think if they kept their chia fields, they probably would have won, you know?
Yeah.
That maybe found a little gunpowder. But it was, you know, it's amazing that back in the time of the Aztecs, that they lived roughly to the age of 38, where in France, in most of Europe, people lived to the age of 28 or 29. So they were much healthier, much greater longevity. And women there, you know, had many more children, they were healthier children than any place in Europe. So it's one of the most successful cultures anywhere, and it's because of the foods that they had. You know, this Aztec diet was just staggering in terms of its power and breadth.
Well, the thing is, here we are in 2013. We don't know everything, but we do know a lot more. And so we can take some of the things that were good from a long time ago, but we don't live in that time anymore, and a lot of things have changed. But we certainly can use and make a benefit of the things that we know are good and bring it into the 21st century. And things like you mentioned, kale and blueberries, I mean, these are easily accessible foods, and they do amazing things. But I think we agree that the key is to get people off of the junk, the high glycemic load, highly processed food, and get them to eating more fruits and vegetables and whole foods and chia and quinoa and amaranth.
And the thing is that, you know, everybody knows they're supposed to do it, but they can't do it. And the secret here is you start out with these smoothies that are great tasting. I mean, like you went to a juice bar, and it tastes unbelievably great. And I think it's because, you know, the fruits, a little honey in there makes it taste great, and the chia, and even a little Greek yogurt, if, you know, if that's something that your diet allows. But then you add all these vegetables in, and they taste amazingly great. You know, it sort of disguises them. It hides your veggies so that you're able to, you know, get all these amazing nutrients and not feel that you're, you know, having to gag on vegetables. In fact, Barbara Rolls, one of the researchers that we point out in the book, talks about hiding your veggies, and that's the way to do it. You hide your veggies, and you feel proud of it. I mean, I'm not a big vegetable eater, but now I have my 9 servings a day because I put them all in a shake, disguised with blueberries and cantaloupe and bananas and a little bit of honey, and it tastes amazingly great.
Now let's talk about you not being a big vegetable eater. Now, why do you have a problem eating vegetables, Bob? Really?
Well, you know, it's very interesting that, you know, they actually, there's a gene apparently for vegetable eaters that they don't mind a bitter kind of taste, and they live longer, and it's a great kind of asset. When I was a kid, my parents almost force fed me, you know, cauliflower and Brussels sprouts, and I just it really.
Now, I think I could be wrong, but I think when you start in with these smoothies, which is a great idea because they taste great, slowly your taste buds will change and you'll start to appreciate some of these vegetables on their own.
Well, and that's what we actually do in the book. That is, we have amazing recipes in there. So I do that. For instance, I make a turkey burger now that has kale and amaranth in it. So there are amazing ways of doing that. If you want to stay completely vegetarian, again, great, great dishes where you do get to appreciate the taste. And I agree with you. I mean, I really have, I tremendously appreciate the kind of you know, nice crisp bitter taste of kale now, so I'll have it in my salads and other places. So I look at chia really as sort of like a starter drug, starter food. You know, if you haven't gone this way, you'll start to go that way. And you're right, your taste buds do change. You do accept these other things, but it's great to have a start that's powerful.
Now, you started the book talking about a number of different scales or ways to evaluate different foods, and I thought that was great. And maybe we can touch on some of them so that people understand how to, what's in their food and what isn't in their food. So the first one is the Andy score, which Whole Foods uses a lot. And if you've been in Whole Foods, you can see them. But what I like about it is it scores kale number one with 1,000 points. There's nothing kale can't do. It's amazing. And then all the other fruits and vegetables fall in line.
And it's great. You know, we looked at all of these different scales, and there are a lot of very good ones out there. I do like Andy. And the tricky thing is that you take a look at a burger, fries, soft drink meal, and on that Andy table, you're going to get a 23. But what's even more surprising is that if you take what's, a healthy all-American meal, with some chicken and rice and stewed veggies or whatever, you only get 320 points, keeping in mind, as you say, that kale gets 1,000 points. So with the Aztec diet, by the time you finish breakfast, you've got 3,328 Andy points. That's more nutrition than most people get in a whole month, and you've got it in the morning. And that's, I think, why I feel, and people on the Aztec diet just feel the best that they've ever felt, because on a relative scale, the average American, out of 100% is getting maybe 3% is a score for their nutrients. And when we bring them up to 500%, they just can't ever believe that they could feel that good in their whole life.
Yeah, it's amazing. Now, the question is, how did we get to this crazy place to begin with where everybody's so sick and eating all the wrong foods?
It's a very interesting thing. One thing about this book is we go into a lot of traditional peoples and how when they were on the traditional diets, like the Aztecs or like the Maori in New Zealand or like the Pima Indians in Arizona, the Native Hawaiians out in Oahu, and they were tall, strong, Olympic-looking peoples, for tens of thousands of years. And then when we inflicted on them this Western diet, I mean, they had staggering levels of obesity and diabetes and heart disease. Miserable. So what this book advocates more than anything else is going back to the traditional diets, because those traditional diets have cultural values that they embrace. For instance, the Native Hawaiians embrace their cultural values as a way of going back to these diets. They want to do it because it's who they are culturally rather than just going on a diet. So I think it's a very, very interesting sell. A big part of why, of course, we've gone to this fast food diet is because it's fast. And so we tried to solve that problem in the book. And I actually have a video up online that shows that in 90 seconds, I can prepare a whole day's worth of smoothies. I mean, with every imaginable, vegetable and fruit and just tremendous stuff in it. And like today, I get up in Vermont with a couple of ski runs, make myself three big bike bottles full of these chia smoothies, and I just drink them all day long. And in that way, it makes it fast, and you're never hungry, which is, I think, the most important part of the Aztec diet book is you're just never hungry.
Now, do you know the history between, after the Aztecs were gone and now we're here in 2013, when did chia get reintroduced? How did we get to know chia again?
Well, back in the 1890s, there were scholars who went out across the American West, and it grew in places where other plants wouldn't grow. There were couriers who would actually go from the Colorado River all the way out to the Pacific Ocean there just taking chia as their fuel. So there was some lore about it, but it's a very, very hard crop to grow. It was only back around 1978, Al Bushway from the University of Maine, their agriculture department up there, started researching and found all these amazing, staggering health values. And slowly, it made its way back into sort of health stores, as you can imagine, out in California in the, 60s and 70s and 80s. And then really starting in 2005, science swooped in. And as we started to see these very, very good, strong studies on its composition and its health effects, it started to grow. And it's really only been over the last year or so that it's really sort of entered the public consciousness. And for a very interesting reason, and that is, chia really is an ingredient, which is odd. I mean, kale's a food, hamburger's a food, french fries are a food, but it's an ingredient. So people have to get used to the idea they're going to add it to something, that they'll add it to a recipe, add it to a soup, add it to their cereal, or as we recommend, that they add it to a smoothie.
Right. You're not going to sit down and have chia for lunch. It's got to be mixed with something because it doesn't taste like much, but it can be kind of gross, especially, you know, if you mix it with water, it's a little gooey.
But the interesting thing is just that gooiness. We call it mucilaginous. And what it means is that gooey substance is what actually sticks in your stomach. So we had oatmeal as kids to stick in your stomach. This probably sticks in your stomach 10 times longer than oatmeal. And that's the secret of it, is that the chia stays in your stomach so long that it just kills your hunger for hours long as you can possibly imagine. But the best thing about chia is it doesn't have any taste. So whether you put it in a smoothie or your Gatorade or some water or whiskey or whatever you want to put it in, you know, it doesn't have a taste. And so it's easy to have, you know, what I think is the number one food in the world.
Yeah, well, I think it's unfortunate today that so many people want their food to be easy, and as a result, they may make the wrong choices. So it is attractive to know that they have some choices that are easy but are good for them and can actually help them lose weight. Just one more thing.
Totally great.
I want to talk about, and that's inflammation. So you have, you include this, some of the foods that have scores for their inflammation potential. Can you explain some of that?
Sure. So one of the most important things in all of health today is inflammation. That is, 50% of heart disease is due to inflammation. You know, some cancers are grown by inflammation. But I think the number one point is this, that if you look at the average American woman who's overweight, she is a cauldron of inflammation in her blood, in her brain, in every organ. And she gets up and she feels terrible every single day. So with this diet, you're able to take your inflammation levels from a negative 1,800, which is a terrible score, up to a positive 3,000 or 4,000 or 5,000. So with that difference of like 6,000 to 8,000 in your inflammation levels, it just turns your brain around. Inflammation in your brain makes all the wrong neurotransmitters or cuts down on the good neurotransmitters. You feel terrible. Again, you know, heart disease, blood vessel disease, lung disease. You know, your whole body really is on fire inside with inflammation. And it's why people feel so good. There actually is a test for inflammation called CRP or C-reactive protein. Mm-hmm. And we tested all of our dieters. And the intriguing thing is that CRP came down in every single one of them.
Mm. Yeah, people probably don't even realize that that's really a great marker to test health before you really find out what's going on, that C-reactive protein.
Maybe the best call.
Yeah, I could, because it can really predict things before it's too late.
I totally agree.
Because it shows that inflammation, yeah. So what are some of the best foods for that score high on anti-inflammation that don't cause inflammation?
Well, you know, we have these premium foods.
Chia seeds?
It's clear. Chia seeds are very, very good. But also, you know, when you look at the veggies, you know, clearly look at kale, watercress, collard greens, all at 1,000. You have spinach at 700. You kind of come down from there. But the intriguing thing I learned many years ago from Center for the Science of the Public Interest is, you know, you don't have to have tons and tons of vegetables. You have to have the right ones. So, you know, you might have lettuce as an example, which probably is an Annie score of, you know, like 50 versus kale at 1,000. Mm-hmm. Well, why not have the kale? So you mm-hmm. can have fewer, better foods. And, you know, the surprising thing to me in writing the Aztec diet was that if you take any food group, if you look at the top 10, by the time you're at the bottom of the top 10, you're not very good. I mean, not bad for you, but, you know, you go from 1,000 points down to probably 200 in the veggie table by the time you've, you know, gone from number 1 down to number 10. And the same thing's true, you know, for meats and fruits and grains and whatnot. So there are – I'm a big believer when you diet, if you want to be healthy, you don't need a huge variety of foods. You need to pick just a very few foods that are unbelievably good with you and stick with those.
I think most people like to have the same things most of the time anyway. We really don't like change. So the thing is to do the work, get to the right place, and then find the foods that are really going to work for you.
No, I totally agree. Totally agree.
And then, you know, occasionally you can go
diet.
Out. A what?
We call it the dull diet, you know.
Well, but it's not.
Well, I know. No, it's good for you. But you were saying about, you know, going out to eat. The great thing about the Aztec diet is when you go out, sure, you want to try to make the right choices. I try to sit down, tell people not to bring any bread, you know, dig into the main course as quickly as I can to fill myself up. But look, you know, we have holidays. We have Thanksgiving. We have birthdays. We have weddings. We all overeat at those. And the great joy of the Aztec diet is the day after you come home, you start the chia shakes again, the weight comes off, and you feel amazing. So it allows you to enjoy your life, but at the same time, get right back on the wagon.
Well, I know that when I indulge myself the next day, that's all I want to do is to get right back, because I know how good it feels when I'm doing the right thing. And, you know, and when you wean yourself off the bad foods and then you kind of let yourself have them again, sometimes that turns people totally off of them because they see how bad it makes them feel.
Yeah, no, I mean, if I go to a party now, I almost dread them. I'll actually bring a thermos of a chia shake along with me.
Yeah, I like to tell people to eat a lot before they know they're going to a dangerous event so that
that's good advice. Well, all your advice is so good, you know?
Thank you. Well, Bob, thank you for joining me on It's All About Food, and thanks for telling the world about this miracle superfood, chia. And if you need any more tips on your opera work, I'd be happy to help you with them some other time.
Well, I'd be like, buy a copy of The Aztec Diet, and I'll get an opera lesson from you.
Okay, that sounds good.
Thank you so much.
Okay,
what
thank
a pleasure.
You. Okay.
You're welcome.
So, we have a few more minutes left, and let's just digest what we talked about today, okay? I'm still digesting my lunch, which is one of those indulgent things that I had, and I can't wait to get back to my juicing and kale salads. Interesting things were brought up in this book, The Aztec Diet, that we just talked about, Chia Power, the superfood that gets you skinny and keeps you healthy. And as I said earlier, I wanted to talk about the things that I agreed with, but I have to say that there are things in the book that I personally wouldn't promote. And so I like to keep that in mind. I definitely promote chia seeds are great. I think it's great to mix them up with flax seeds and other foods that give you a lot of omega-3 fatty acids. We don't know enough about chia yet. I've seen all kinds of different numbers about nutritional value in chia. And some people like to know, is flax better than chia? Is chia better than flax? I think variety works best. And maybe we'll learn more about chia as time goes on. I know that flax has more lignans, and lignans are great for fighting cancer. But I don't like to look at what's in food and keep track of the numbers. Now, sometimes it really helps when people are making a change in their diet to see what foods are going to give them more of good things rather than less. But ultimately, I think it's really good to land in a place where you don't have to keep score. You don't have to be counting. And that's the beauty of green plant foods, vegetables, beans. You can just eat them until you're satisfied, right? And then get on with your day. Okay. Well, I wanted to remind you, and I didn't say this at the beginning of the program, but I like to hear from you, and you're certainly welcome to call in during the program and ask questions. It's kind of the end of the program, so that's not really the right time to say it. But in the future, please do. And you can always send me an email at info@realmeals.org, info@realmeals.org. If there's something you liked or something you didn't like or something you agree with or didn't agree with, you can write me and let me know. I really need and love to hear from you. And we are continuing over at my nonprofit, ResponsibleEatingAndLiving.com, ResponsibleEatingAndLiving.com, with our transcription project, which is enabling us to put into text all of these different programs so you can access them not only in the audio podcast, but read and remember some of the information even better. Well, it's time to go. Thank you for listening. I'm Karen Hartglass. It's been a great moment here with It's All About Food. Have a delicious week.